Hi, welcome to Trained. At Nike, we believe that greatness isn't born, it's trained. And that means more than just a workout. Each episode, we'll bring you conversations with leading experts in what we call the five facets of fitness: training, recovery, nutrition, mindset, and sleep. I'm Ryan Flaherty, Senior Director of Performance at Nike. I train some of the world's best athletes, like Saquon Barkley, Russell Wilson, and Marcus Mariota. Today, we're focusing on the importance of recovery and how incorporating it into your training can push you forward in unexpected ways. You're listening to Trained, presented by Nike.
We can't train 24 hours a day for a reason. You know, if you train 4 hours a day, the other 20 hours are really important. Just focusing all on the training and not on the recovery can be a big mistake. We want to not scare people off. You know, we want people to be exercising for life. You know, exercise is medicine. It's the best thing you can do for your body for prevention of pretty much every disease. So we want people to exercise for a lifetime.
That's Dr. Shona Halson, Associate Professor in the School of Behavioral and Health Sciences at the Australian Catholic University. She was formerly the Senior Recovery Physiologist at the Australian Institute of Sport, and she was the Director of the Australian Olympic Committee Recovery Centre for the 2008, 2012, and 2016 Games. Shona's also a member of the Nike Training Performance Council. I got to sit down with Shona when she was in town for a meeting with the Nike Sports Research Lab and get into the science of recovery, sleep, and nutrition. Shona has expertise in all three areas, and many of her studies look at how one facet impacts the other. Shona began her career studying overtraining in cyclists and has gone on to work with some of the world's highest performing athletes on their recovery routines and methods. I was excited to talk to someone immersed in exercise science. Shona has worked with athletes in a wide variety of sports. And I think the fact that one of Shona's main research interests is overtraining can tell us a lot about how we as a culture approach both training and behavior change. Ironically, it's low-impact sports where people are at risk to overtrain. But it makes sense. If you run too much, your knees will tell you immediately, and it's going to hurt. With athletes like swimmers and cyclists who have no contact with the ground, their signs of overtraining are fatigue and irritability, two things easy enough to attribute to everyday life. But Shona says she sees a lot more under-recovery than overtraining. Things like neglecting to sleep the right amount or to make the space and time for muscles to recover. This is true not just for elite athletes, but for us weekend warriors too. We live in a culture that encourages active engagement at all times, so it can be hard to do things that don't have clear, objective outcomes. Spending an hour or two without your phone, meditating, or stretching are important, but easy to sidestep if the results aren't immediately visible. Sleep is the classic example. When Shona looks at her athletes' schedules, sleep is often the form of recovery that gets cut back first in favor of other activities. Longtime listeners know we love to talk about sleep, and you can check out our episodes with Dr. Matthew Walker or Dr. Sherry Ma, where we go deep into the power of sleep. But sleep isn't the only tool for recovery. Shona and I get into the pros and cons of hydropressure, cryotherapy, compression, massage, and more. She'll also talk to us about how to balance the demands of short-term and long-term outcomes when developing a recovery and training plan. And I hope that this conversation will inspire you to actually create a recovery plan, because I know it's something we can all use more of. So now, let's get to the interview. Well, Shona, thank you for joining us today. We appreciate it.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks for the invitation.
Absolutely. So you have a lot of titles, a lot of background. Would you please just give us a little background on your education and what work you're into, what field you're in?
Yeah, sure. So I started out with my PhD in the area of overtraining, particularly in cyclists, so looking at what happens when you do too much exercise. Then moved on to the Institute of Sport, where I worked for nearly 16 years. And the role there was a combination of servicing, direct servicing with athletes, some research and some education for the athletes. Now moved to Australian Catholic University, and my role there is primarily research. I've got some students and working still in the area of recovery.
Yeah. Can you talk a little bit about the Australian Institute of Sport? Because it's very unique what you guys do compared to what the United States does. Because here everything's privately funded, whereas yes. in Australia it's not. It's government funded. So can you talk a little bit about the uniqueness of the Australian Institute of Sport and how awesome that is for the athletes that are there?
Yeah, so it certainly evolved and has evolved over the years and for the time that I was there, but it has been really unique in that it has been a centralised location for athletes, coaches, as well as scientists. So in the early days, we were really able to do some great applied research because we were essentially living with the athletes and the coaches, and you'd see them all day on campus and develop those relationships and trust so that you could do some good applied research.
Yeah, and how long were you there? How long were you with this institute?
Total of almost 16 years.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's amazing.
So it was a decent chunk of time.
Yeah. So what athletes did you work with while you were there? Did you have a specialty or did you work with abroad?
I worked with across a lot of different sports, a lot of different athletes. Primarily, though, we had a focus on our top priority athletes. Mm-hmm. So for us, that was things like swimming, cycling, rowing, sailing, some of our more popular, our chances of winning more medals at the Olympics, essentially.
And your focus was on recovery. So what were some of the modalities you worked with? What were some of the techniques you used to help the athletes recover?
Yeah, so early on we started really around the water immersion. So things like your ice baths and spa and contrast baths. I did a lot of research in that area to try and give it some background evidence. Mm-hmm. Worked as well in the area of compression. So did quite a bit of and still do a bit of research in that area. A link with the nutrition department around optimal ways to recover from a nutrition point of view. But really, they were the experts in terms of referring to the dietitians. And then sleep. Probably in the last 7 or 8 years, we've had a real focus on trying to maximize sleep, understand how athletes sleep, and then what we can do about it.
Yeah, sleep's really having its time in the sun right now, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's pretty amazing to see how broad it is. Can you talk a little bit about what were some of the protocols you guys put in with athletes to help them sleep better? Some of the levers you pulled to help athletes improve their quality of sleep during the day?
Yeah, that's a great question. What we originally started out doing was actually measuring their sleep, first of all. Because when we first went to the literature to see how athletes sleep, there was almost zero science. So the first thing was to understand how they're sleeping and then give the athlete some individual objective information, so have the actual numbers. Mm-hmm. And then what we'd do is talk through that with them and then give them some strategies. So it's interesting in that of most of my time working with athletes, we've seen very few sleep medical disorders, so, you know, real medical issues.
Sure.
It's mostly behavioural. People just doing strange things or things that just aren't good for their sleep. So things like being on social media and just sneaking into sleep time with other things that are, you know, more fun.
Yeah.
And so what happens is, you know, sleep gets shorter and shorter. And then really for us, it's around trying to educate the athletes that sleep is a really fundamental part of your recovery, like the most important thing that you can do.
Yeah.
And educating them on some of the consequences of poor sleep, but then really what could happen to your performance if you actually nailed it and you did things really well from a sleep perspective. So
it's kind of like the best PED available that's legal, right? I mean, when you really think about it, when you dive into the what happens when you sleep, everything is there.
It is, exactly right. The hormonal release, the effects on the brain, the muscle repair, like it is absolutely all there. It's the one thing that you can do that's legal, but very few athletes, in my experience, do it really, really well.
You know, one of the areas, too, I think when you hear a lot of people talk about it, you hear things like, well, you know, I'll have a couple glasses of wine before I go to bed or, you know, I watch TV to go to bed. And both of those can have big impacts. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about, let's start with alcohol, maybe. Mm-hmm. What's the impact on alcohol on your sleep?
Yeah. So the initial thing that alcohol typically does is to actually help you fall asleep quicker, which is a positive. However, most people get into a trap of thinking that it actually helps their overall sleep. So it is the number one used tool for self-medicating for sleep. But what happens primarily throughout the night of sleep is that the depth of sleep is reduced. So the quality is reduced. So I guess the simple way to think about it is it's a poison. It's a toxin. Your body's trying to get rid of it. So when you're really hoping to be getting deep restorative sleep, the body's trying to clear this product that is technically harmful.
Yeah. I want to jump back because you mentioned two other things earlier. One of them was compression and the second one was cold water immersion. Yep. Let's talk with compression first. Can you talk about compression and what it's good for and how people can utilize that to help them recover?
Yeah. So compression for recovery, essentially the way we think about it is it's like medical grade compression. You know, where things come in recovery, a lot of things come from the medical world. And we think, okay, if it works for a sick or an ill patient, it might work in tired.
In performance.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So we translate it to athletes. So the reason, the mechanism around compression is really around constricting the peripheral vessels to force the blood flow to go through the deeper vessels, which can influence influence your cardiac output and obviously change your blood flow. So, and there is some evidence now around the use of compression in the recovery period for enhanced performance. We've also just finished some research where we looked at muscle oscillation, so muscle vibration, muscle wobble, and found that there's reduced muscle oscillation with compression, which you'd imagine it would. Like, I'm sure you've worn them and you know what that sensation is like. But, you know, that may result in reduced muscle damage if you're wearing them during exercise. And as you said, they can, you know, people generally wearing compression, it can feel good. So that pressure sensation to the brain can take the place of the pain information going to the brain. So they are, I think, an effective recovery tool. They're relatively cheap. They're fairly practical in comparison to, say, an ice bath. There's something that everyone can do.
That's a great tip, because compression can be affordable. Is there a type of compression that's better? Is there like a graded compression that's right? Or what should people be looking for there?
Yeah, generally the theory is around the graduated compression, so sort of tighter at the ankle and then looser as it goes on to enforce that change in blood flow. But really for recovery, the general recommendations are to wear the tightest pair that's comfortable.
Okay. For us, the non-competitive athletes that are training to be healthy and fit and live a long time, what would you say is a general rule of thumb when it comes to using cold baths to help us with our recovery and performance?
Yeah, so I think that the cold baths and ice baths are probably the sorts of things that are more like the icing on the cake. I would really consider things like sleep and nutrition as your foundation and the things that we shouldn't skip. If you do have extra time, things like stretching and compression are good. Water immersion, I definitely think, is effective, but it can be one of the less practical things to do. But if you can get in, like everyone has to shower, right? Should shower.
Yeah, yeah.
So cold showers can be really good, especially in warm environments. Going down to the ocean or to a river or getting in a pool, that can also be effective. So really what you're looking for is water temperature colder than your skin temperature. So skin temperature is usually, I'm going to be in Celsius here.
Yeah, that's okay.
But around about 34, 35 degrees. So anything less than that is going to actually eventually cool you down. Yeah. So you can make it practical. You don't always have to fill up, a bath of some kind or have the latest, greatest facilities. You can use your own shower, your own bath, your pool or something like that to cool the body down.
Can you talk a little bit about where active recovery is best suited and who it's right for? And what is active recovery, if you could define it for us?
Great question. So I think of active recovery as low intensity exercise. And the most people would use an active recovery for two reasons. Firstly is to clear lactate, which, yes and no, there's pros and cons to that. And the second is just to feel better. So a lot of people feel that if they just stop exercise and don't do some kind of active recovery or your classic warm down, then people might feel that they get a little bit sorer. The times when I think it's really important for people, and I'm talking, I guess, mainly here, people who are in a competition setting, is we know that if you still have, you know, lactate in the system, that it can cause fatigue and reduce your ability to perform again. So say if I was working with cyclists who had to do two maximum efforts with half an hour apart, they would be warming down.
Yeah.
You want to clear that lactate so they can do their best in the next effort. If I'm working with someone, and swimmers are actually classic who do this, they swim down a lot. They swim down more than they, you know, I think. Yeah, exactly. And I think they just use more fuel and cause more fatigue. So I think that there's times where, yes, we might need to warm down, but we've got to think, you know, lactate clears itself pretty quick, half a millimole a minute, right? So if you simply do nothing, it will go away.
Sure.
But the thing about the active recovery is including that if you want to clear the lactate, if you want to be, you want to be performing at your best in a fairly short period of time.
So talking about some of, you know, the everyday athletes who are doing high intensity training, where generally if you go 5-6 days a week, it'll be high intensity every single day.
Yeah.
What are some things that they can do in that type of high intensity environment to help them recover? Maybe things that they're not doing today that you could help them understand that they do need to be doing.
Yeah, I think one of the things that we see in the general population, even the individuals that are training really hard, is that they're often balancing work as well as their training. What often happens is sleep is decreased so that they can actually get up early and train, or they're training late at night and that interferes with their sleep. So I think one of the things is to make sure that they're, you know, getting adequate sleep in terms of their overall recovery, the number one thing that they can do. And I think sometimes there's a real balance between getting that extra session in and actually getting the benefits of the sleep. So I think obviously sleep and nutrition, well known as good recovery strategies. I think things like your compression and your water immersion would be effective.
Okay.
Soft tissue or massage, definitely.
Yeah.
Again, it's one of those things you've got to try and fit in. But I think they're kind of your key, you know, recovery variables. And then also I think it's understanding that rest days are good days too. You know, adaptation
happens
in rest. Yeah. And we can't train 24 hours a day for a reason. You know,
right.
If you train 4 hours a day, the other 20 hours are really important. And what we do in that time really assists those 4 hours of training and what you get from it. So
absolutely.
Not ignoring those, just focusing all on the training and not on the recovery can be a big mistake.
We're going to take a quick break, but when we come back, Shona will tell us what to consider in designing a recovery program and how it will help you get through high-pressure situations. Stick around, we'll be right back. If you're a trainer, join a community of trainers looking to make fitness better for everyone. Learn from leading experts in performance, mindset, nutrition, recovery, and sleep, and get an exclusive 30% discount on Nike gear. Apply at nike.com/ntcpro. I want to jump back because you mentioned massage therapy, manual therapy.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about manual therapy, massage therapy, mm-hmm. The research behind it, and then where it would be effective for somebody to use?
Yeah. So early on, the research was all around clearing lactate, which is really interesting because that's what I think people thought it did, and it certainly doesn't do that. That's not the focus of massage. There is some really interesting research now coming out of the UK looking at massage as a recovery tool in terms of muscle repair. So there's some quite strong information coming out in that particular area. So when I'm thinking massage as a recovery strategy, I'm thinking things around muscle repair. I'm thinking really around the feel-good factor as well.
Mm-hmm.
So who doesn't love
a
massage,
yeah.
a flush, something,
yeah.
you know, nice.
Well, the nervous system effect on it, right?
Absolutely.
I mean, yeah, that's big. I think a lot of people don't realize that how little they go back between sympathetic, parasympathetic, and how just something as simple as relaxing in a massage setting will do that for you.
Yes. And one thing that I always encourage people I work with to do is get off your phones while you're getting a massage. Actually enjoy it.
Sure.
We often have athletes that will, you know, sleep on the massage table, so we know they're sleep deprived. But it is a time that you can really use, you know, we're really into mental recovery and winding down and taking away all the stresses that we have.
Why is being on your phone constantly not a good thing for you?
Yeah, so I think there's a number of things around phone use, and I link it really closely to its impact on sleep. And so what we see is there's a number of reasons where the blue light from the phones we know is bad for the body clock. It's also, you know, social media in particular is interactive. And so what we really want is in that time frame before sleep is for us to be winding down. And what are we doing? We're putting light and a stimulus right in front of people's faces.
Yeah.
And I think also we need to give ourselves some downtime, some time away where we're just not mentally challenged all the time. And for some people, whether it's email, whether it's, you know, social media, you know, the use of things that are competitive as well can be really stimulating. So I think it's just giving yourself some downtime and switching the brain off and getting away from this constant stimulation that we have.
Yeah. So one of the things I love about this podcast and doing this podcast is when it comes to training, nutrition, recovery, sleep, all of it, there's a lot of misinformation, probably more than there is good information, as you know, being the research and scientist that you are. What I love about this is being able to bring people like you on, you know, and never speaking in absolutes, it's always changing, but based on what we know today, you have a clear insight, a look into what is really effective and what isn't. So going through a few other things, right now, one area I wanted to talk to you about that's getting a lot of traction is cryotherapy. Is it effective? Based on the research we have out today, what is your take on cryo?
Yeah, so in terms of the cryotherapy chambers, there's evidence around reduction in inflammation. So again, it's one of those things that started in the medical world, particularly in inflammatory disorders like rheumatoid arthritis. Mm-hmm. So a lot of people started using it for that reason. What you don't get with the cryotherapy chambers that you get with an ice bath is you don't get the hydrostatic pressure of the water. So because it's just air, you don't have that water pressure. So the water pressure is really, really powerful. So if you think of compression garments might be, say, 20 millimetres of mercury pressure at the ankle, if you're like your height, you're probably getting about 150, 160 millimetres of mercury pressure at the ankle.
Gotcha.
So that's the water is really compressive. It is also a really great medium to conduct temperature.
Okay.
25 times better than air. So you've got these really cold cryotherapy chambers that, yes, may reduce a little bit of inflammation, but the mechanisms are slightly different. Now, the actual research in that area in terms of performance is not very strong. So there's not a lot out there saying that cryotherapy chambers are good for performance. There's actually one study that showed that ice baths were actually better than the chambers. And I think that's that hydrostatic pressure, water effect, and the ability to conduct heat.
Okay, moving down the line, flotation tanks.
Yes. Now, I like flotation tanks. Again, very little science, but I think, you know, a lot of these strategies, we might not have the science, but we can look at the mechanisms and we can understand,
absolutely,
you know, this is probably going to be effective and, number one, do no harm. So, but the thing I really like about a float tank is you can't bring your phone in there.
It's always getting back to the same thing.
Yeah, sorry, I shouldn't have said that. It's all about the phone for me.
Yeah.
Now, I think, and again, when we're thinking mental relaxation, when we're talking about switching off, I think when you learn to quieten the brain and when you can switch off in a float tank, when you start to be able to do that, you can take that with you wherever you go. And maybe that's helpful for sleep. I know the military are doing work with float tanks around concussions and traumatic brain injury and some of those different areas that are important for, you know, for the military. But I think there's something that I would advocate, even though there's not a lot of science there. I think practically there's something that's good to do.
Yeah.
And especially if you're someone who's a, you know, 24/7 busy person, if you can take an hour out of the day for yourself and have a float, I think that's a good thing to do.
I could not agree more. Are there any new recovery methods coming that you are especially excited about?
Yeah, I am interested in, and I think where recovery will be heading is really around the mental recovery and the brain recovery and downtime. Like, I think that's going to be really key. There's not a lot of companies that are out there that are doing it at the moment really well, but I think there will be in the future. And I think looking at ways of enhancing sleep and working with, you know, the environment of sleep and how our behaviours are around sleep, I think that's going to also one of the big directions.
Yeah.
I don't know in terms of like actual products. I think we're kind of saturated in the market with things, but I think we'll be looking at the brain and we'll be looking at sleep as the big two.
Yeah. And bringing up the brain, what about meditation for recovery? Is that something you have your athletes use?
Yeah, we have over the years, you know, experimented with different things, but I do believe that anything like meditation, relaxation, progressive muscle relaxation, mindfulness, those kinds of things can have a positive impact, particularly on sleep, but also on just that ability to kind of calm the brain down a little bit. So, you know, we know mind-body connection, we know mental stress and the physiological effects of mental, you know, stress and activity. So I think anything like that can help with the brain and shutting it down a little bit is a good thing.
Yeah. So like bringing it back to probably, you know, our average listener who is on their fitness journey somewhere but wants to incorporate the right type of stretching, what would you recommend for them?
Yeah. Look, really simply, I think that stretching has kind of lost a little bit of its importance over the last few years. But I would say that a lot of people report that they don't feel as sore if they do a decent stretch. In the recovery period, it tends to be more of a static type stretching, not going through an absolutely crazy range, you know, just doing really the simple basics of stretching the muscles that you have used. If you feel feel like it works for you. I know some people that just stay away from it, but I think that if it's something that makes you feel better the next day, and that's one of the things I think about with recovery strategies is, well, you may not like it at the time, like a nice bath, sure. But does it make you feel better the yeah. next day and help you on your ability to repeat your training? So I think short static stretches, nothing too extreme, and you don't need to spend, 45 minutes doing your stretches. Yeah. Something simple.
So talking about a little bit on mindset now, mm-hmm. The research you've done in cyclists and overtraining, mm-hmm. How would you define overtraining?
Yeah, overtraining is interesting because a lot of people use it as the outcome as well as the process. Like, I'm overtraining and then I become overtrained. But I think...
It's really hard to overtrain, right? I mean, like, very small percentage of us everyday athletes are... It'd be really hard to overtrain. Is that accurate?
Yeah, I think it's abnormal to want to physically push yourself to a point where you actually experience that. But I think we see... I don't know if we see overtraining as much as we see under recovery. I think real classic overtraining syndrome, or the overtraining syndrome as it's officially defined, I think we don't see as much of that. I think what we see is, under recovery, stress, people not sleeping. That's what's actually leading to the underperformance.
Okay.
So I think that, yes, overtraining happens because probably people aren't really incorporating their recovery. But one of the other things that I find really interesting is the type of sports where you can overtrain. Mm. So with my research, I looked at cyclists, and you can, because there's no impact with the ground, there's no contact, you can put an athlete, a swimmer and a cyclist, you can put them in a fatigue hole pretty quick. Mm. If you're a runner, you'll tend to get injured first.
Yeah.
Or you're a football player, Absolutely. You'll tend to get beaten up and then you'll get injured. So I think there's some sports where you can push people and push people and push people and they get those classic signs. And there's others that will, the body's saying, hang on, you've got to stop. I'm going to get sick or I'll get injured as a way of saying just back off.
Yeah. What are those signs? Is it getting sick and injured, or was there anything you can tell before that?
We tend to see a couple of things change. Sleep definitely seems to be related, whether it's, the cause or the consequence, mm-hmm. But sleep is definitely affected. Mood is a one that changes pretty quickly.
Got it.
And I think irritability is the big one. So as part of some of my research, I measured everything under the sun to try to understand what causes overtraining. Hormones, we did stable isotope infusion, we did everything. And the best predictor was questionnaires.
Wow.
Using mood. Yeah. Wow. Wasted a lot of money.
Yeah.
but I think that asking people how they feel, if they're honest, and I think the other thing is, can you do what you'd normally do? Like, say you do a session on a pretty similar session on a Monday and a pretty standard session on a Tuesday, and Tuesday you're just not feeling the same. Mm-hmm. So that's a good way of saying maybe I'm really not recovered as I normally would be.
Sure.
And that's a way of kind of keeping track.
Yeah. No, that's great. So can you just talk about how we always try to separate things out, but the way our bodies work, especially in performance and training, it's so interconnected. Can you just talk through that a little bit?
Yeah, look, 100%. And I think the great example of that is, as physiologists, we spend our life measuring things in the periphery. Mm. And now if I could have done another degree, I would have done psychology, because I think so much of what we do, especially around behavior change, is psychology. But
yeah.
I really think that we cannot, underestimate the importance of psychology. But I think the thing is there's lots of debates in the physiology world about, the central governor theory and, all these different things around the brain. But we can't get away from the fact that the brain and the body are connected, luckily. and, what happens in, centrally or what happens peripherally is going to have an influence on the other. And so when you're talking about recovery, it's particularly multidisciplinary because of the importance of all these different areas and how they interact. So we know, obviously, mentally, when we're stressed, we have a physiological response. We know that nutrition is important for recovery. It also may be linked with sleep. We know that if you're stressed or anxious, you don't sleep very well. We know that, other strategies like compression and water immersion affect the body itself, but when something feels good, it affects the brain as well. So it is all totally connected. And I think if you only look at each section in isolation, you're missing a big part of the picture.
Yeah. So I wanted to go a little bit deeper on nutrition and recovery and just talk about some specific foods that help in recovery and why.
Yeah, so I think when you're looking for specific foods, you're looking to make sure you target the big ones of carbohydrate and protein. Mm-hmm. So, you know, your carbohydrate can be, you know, obviously we like to go for the things like, your pastas and things like that, that have, you know, good carbohydrates in it, bread, those kinds of things. You know, protein as, you know, obviously meat, yogurts, those types of things. So we're looking for good quality foods that contain carbohydrate, that contain protein. We're obviously looking as well at making sure they're adequately hydrated. So it's really around, incorporating some real food with good nutritional value in it as well. And, you know, it depends on the type of activity you've done. Obviously, you know, if you're someone who's into CrossFit, you might be focusing a little bit more on your protein to repair the muscle. If you're a cyclist who's out there doing, you know, 5 hours on the bike, you might be looking at a little bit more of a carbohydrate replacement. So, and again, looking at, you know, how long you've exercised for and what types of fuels you need to replace.
Right. Okay, so one thing I want to ask you is why should the non-high-performing athlete care about recovery?
I think and I kind of put myself in that category,
sure,
like
yeah.
Very low, not high performance, would be, for me, it's about I want to be injury-free and I want to feel good. You know, there's no reason why I should feel sore all the time.
Sure.
And it's about being consistent and being able to actually get out there and do what I want to do. So, and I think things like, you know, again, your massage, things like that, that might help with maintenance and injury prevention. They're the big ones, especially when you don't have someone monitoring you and watching you and visually, you know, checking your technique in the gym. You know, you got to look after yourself.
Of course.
And that's where I think recovery becomes even more important. And if you've got a job as well and you may travel and you're busy, then you've got to find some time in there to take care of yourself.
Yeah. And I think, you know, the advice I give people sometimes too is taking the long-term approach too and long view. Well, what about when you're 50 years old? How are you going to be moving with kids? And, you know, how active can you be then? And that's why you should care about recovery.
Yeah, exactly. Could not agree more. And we want to not scare people off. You know, we want people to be exercising for life. You know, exercise is medicine. It's the best thing you can do for your body for prevention of pretty much every disease. So we want people to exercise for a lifetime. And sometimes people, and I've done it before, I actually ran a marathon once and then haven't really run since. But we want people to, you know, to have a long-term view. And, you know, whether you might have a short-term goal of what you want to achieve or look like or whatever it might be, but not losing sight of the fact that exactly when you're 50, 60, 70, we want you to be able to, you know, climb a set of stairs.
Shona, thank you so much. I really appreciate the time. I mean, people are going to get so much out of this. So I just, thank you for coming on.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for inviting me and asking such good questions.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate it. I really enjoyed getting into the details of recovery with Shona. But if there's one thing I hope you take away from our conversation, it's this. Recovery can be more than specific activities like water immersion or hydrotherapy. Instead, it can be any light, low-intensity exercise. A slow-flow yoga session is a perfect activity to do instead of your usual workout. It gives you the same mental benefit of an aerobic workout, but with less impact on your joints and muscles. We have great workouts available in the Nike Training Club app of varying intensity, including a restorative series. Go check them out. They're totally free and designed by Nike experts. It can be hard to take a day away from training when you're focused on a goal, but the results of training shouldn't be only physical. So much of it is mental. Learning to be patient with yourself and to give yourself time for recovery is just as valuable as any PR. Trained is produced by Nike Training Club. If you're looking to take your training to the next level, check out the Nike Training Club app. In it, you'll find holistic guidance and free workouts designed by Nike experts. Or go even further with our premium subscription service, NTC Premium, available now in the US. With NTC Premium, you can get guidance from start to finish with programs designed and led by Nike master trainers, including myself, plus immersive guided workouts and in-depth nutrition and wellness content. Go check it out. That's Nike Training Club app, available on both Android and iOS. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next time with pro golfer Rory McIlroy. We'll be talking about his focus on his mindset and how that's impacted his performance. This is Trained. Talk to you soon.
Consult your doctor before engaging in an exercise program of any kind, especially if you have a medical condition. Use good judgment and common sense about your own fitness level and ability when engaging in a training program. If something doesn't feel right, stop immediately and seek medical attention as necessary.